Welcome to the podcast for the Journal of the American Academy of Physician Assistants. Welcome to the JAPA podcast for the September 2017 issue. In this podcast, we're going to summarize and the select articles from this month's JAPA. I'm your co-host, Christopher Madej, Program Director at the UTHSCPA program.
And I'm your co-host, Adrienne Banning, faculty member and EBM course director at the Drexel PA program in Philly.
Hello, Adrienne. How are you been?
Hi, Chris. I'm just sorry that summer is coming to a close. It's my favorite season. How about you?
Nope, negative. I've got way too much insulation to enjoy summer. I'm much more a fall, winter kind of guy. That's what I'm waiting for.
Winter is coming.
Yeah, everybody tells me that the falls in Tennessee are gorgeous, and so I'm waiting around for that day because the heat right now in the South is just awful.
Ah, well, it's really gorgeous here in Philadelphia. But speaking of weather, I'm going to transition to something a little somber. Before we jump in today, we want to say, Houston, Louisiana, we're thinking of you, and we're sorry that you're struggling. To our PA friends there, just tell us what you need. Reach out, and we're here to help, and we're definitely thinking of you.
Absolutely. All right, so back to the recording. So today we are going to summarize a CME article on scleroderma-related pulmonary arterial hypertension, a CME primer for primary care providers on infertility. We'll also cover a 50th anniversary special edition article on the progress made and yet to be made for women in the PA profession, a farm consult on asthma, and recent research on PAs in primary care, and finally, a review article on the effects of obesity on pulmonary function in kids. Just to remind you, this podcast is a summary of just a select few of articles, and our share is our take on and opinions of these articles, and they do not represent the opinions of JAPA, the authors, or the editors, or the publisher. And this is intended as just medical education, not medical advice. So let's get started with the CME. And as a reminder, please make sure that you go to the post-test and website for the CME article so that you can gain your credit. You get one credit for each article. So the website is online that you can find, and just got to score well enough on the test in order to get that credit. So if you're listening to us, please, please, please go check it out and get your CME. So first CME article for the day is going to be on infertility, a primer for primary care providers. And this is by Jill Cunningham, physician assistant, who is also faculty at the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine's PA program. So the numbers, about 1.5 million women between the ages of 15 and 44 years are affected by infertility, and almost 6.7 million women report having impaired ability to conceive. And women over the age of 40 is now the fastest growing age group having children, and this is the first time that this has ever happened in fertility history. So what are the causes? So for both genders, both male and female, age is the most significant risk factor for fecundability, which is a new SAT word that I had never heard of. And this is a medical
vocab.
I know. And it's the medical term for the ability to achieve pregnancy per menstrual cycle. For men, other things that can cause infertility is, again, the age causes sperm count, function, and motility problems. But in women, the most common cause is ovulatory dysfunction, and of that, the most common cause is polycystic ovarian syndrome. There's a lot of other factors. You can go to the journal to look up, but HPA dysfunction, stress, exercise, medication, there's a whole host of other problems that you need to be thinking of. But there's a really good table there that I'm going to go over right now, which is when do you evaluate women for infertility? So when is after 12 months of frequent unprotected intercourse? This should be in women under the age of 35 years that have no risk factors for infertility. Or after 6 months of frequent unprotected intercourse in women 35 to 40 without any significant risk factors for infertility. Or upon presentation or less than 6 months of frequent unprotected intercourse in women over the age of 40, women with a history of oligomenorrhea or amenorrhea, history of chemotherapy, radiation, or advanced stage endometriosis, or known or suspected uterine tubal scarring, adhesions, or leiomyomas. If the male partner has a history of groin or testicular surgery, adult mumps, sexual dysfunction, chemotherapy, radiation, or a history of previous fertility problems, then the male partner should be screened as well. So really good table to keep in your back pocket if you've got patients that you see that you're counseling for infertility. So what do you order for this? In men, it's pretty simple. It's just a semen analysis. Within that, they look at the volume, the sperm concentration, the motility, and the morphology. In women, it's a little bit more tricky. There's a little bit more things that you have to consider, but the most common initial test of choice is going to be a serum progesterone level, typically on day 21 of ovulation. And this just checks to make sure that she is ovulating appropriately, because progesterone is progestation, and it helps support the pregnancy. So if the woman does ovulate, your serum progesterone level should go up to support that pregnancy should it then get impregnated. And if not, then the progesterone levels drop back off again. So they check it at day 21 in order to check to make sure that there's good ovulation going on. There's a host of other endocrine labs that revolve around thyroid function, testosterone level, estrogen levels, the whole host of other things that they have listed in the journal. And then some of the radiography things that you can do, transvaginal or pelvic ultrasound, just looking for mechanical causes such as leiomyomas or other tumors or growths, as well as ovary cysts for PCOS. And then if there is a history of scarring or other endometrial problems, then a hysteroscopy would be warranted in order to be able to look at it. So a very good article on evaluation of infertility for both men and women, and a good breakdown of when to screen and what to screen with.
Thanks, Chris. Our next CME article is Diagnosing and Managing Scleroderma-Related Pulmonary Hypertension by Catherine Alexis Athanasu, PAC, Sanu Sani, MD, Amrinder Rana, MBBS, and Arunab Talwar, MD. So, scleroderma is an autoimmune disease, as we know. It has no known cause, and it's uncommon, but it affects, along with other immunologic abnormalities and excess collagen production, it affects endothelial function, which includes the pulmonary arteries. So patients with scleroderma are prone to interstitial lung disease and pulmonary artery hypertension. And instead of saying that all for the rest of the review, we're just going to say PAH from now on. So good. PAH is actually the leading cause of death in patients with scleroderma. And that's going to be secondary to right heart failure, because that right heart is just pumping so hard against the high pressure in the pulmonary arteries. So we have to be really vigilant for it and screen for it in patients with scleroderma, because now there are so many more meds than before to treat it. And remember that it's only helpful to screen for something if you can actually do something about what you might find. Otherwise, no point in screening. And we can do something about this. So the history and physical that might lead you to think about PAH in a patient with scleroderma are you want to look for it in postmenopausal females specifically, and anyone with scleroderma with dyspnea, fatigue, or syncope. Those things can all be present in interstitial lung disease as well, though, so you have to be sure what you're dealing with and which is which. The article has a great visual breakdown of an algorithm for diagnosing PAH, so head over to the article. On physical exam, you might hear an accentuated pulmonic heart sound, a tricuspid regurg murmur along the left lower sternal border that could increase with inspiration. You might see jugular venous distension, lower extremity edema, pulsatile hepatosplenomegaly, those heart failure signs and symptoms. So to diagnose it, we want a right heart catheterization. That's the gold standard. And there you would see a pulmonary arterial pressure of 25 millimeters of mercury or more when normal is only 8 to 20. You could also get an EKG, transthoracic echo, or a 6-minute walk test. That seems to have good prediction for survival based on the results of the 6-minute walk test. First-line treatment is pharmacologic in using meds to relieve vasoconstriction and prevent arterial remodeling, like the PDE5 inhibitors, and yes, they are the erectile dysfunction meds. We're also looking at endothelin receptor agonists, prostanoids, and more meds, so check out the really helpful table in the article for a complete breakdown. If meds aren't helpful after 3 months, though, in someone who's symptomatic, so a World Health Organization heart failure category of 3 or 4, then a lung transplant is the next procedure of choice. So what else? Last month we talked about high altitude. This is definitely a person, someone with scleroderma with PAH, who should not be traveling to high altitudes. They should be traveling to pulmonary rehabilitation, though. That's going to be helpful, even though before we weren't sure if it was or not. Now it looks like it is. You want to consider diuresis, but not to excess, because these patients need that really good right-sided cardiac preload. Think about anticoagulating, and be sure to screen for and manage depression. This can be a really stressful diagnosis. So in summary, think about PAH in patients with scleroderma, screen for it judiciously, and start treatment quickly. It's rare, but if you don't know to look for it, then you won't.
That's right. Yeah, the PDE5 inhibitors is one of my favorite stories that, you know, they were originally brought on the market for pulmonary artery hypertension and found out that they had a very lucrative side effect that they completely went in the other direction. And, you know, they're still used for the pulmonary hypertension, but they're much more prevalent in the erectile dysfunction world.
Mm-hmm. Your medical history knowledge, Chris, is really vast.
I tell my students this all the time, that I've got this just steel trap of just worthless medical minutia. Like, I can't keep murmurs straight to save my life, but for some reason I can remember stuff like that. And I don't know. It's just one of the, it's a gift and a curse, I suppose.
I see a book in your future.
Yeah, exactly. So the next article we're going to jump into is the Pharm Consult. And the title of this is there a role for anticholinergic therapy in asthma management? And this is written by authors Shannon M. Parkey, who is a fourth-year pharmacy student at East Tennessee State University, and Courtney M. Mossman, who is a PharmD assistant professor of pharmacy at Wingate University School of Pharmacy. So specifically, they wanted to talk about tiotropium bromide, which is a long-acting anticholinergic antagonist, which is a cornerstone for COPD management, but not so much in asthma. And they specifically highlighted the 2016 Global Initiative for Asthma or GINA guidelines for adjuvant therapy in asthma management, specifically at step 4 and step 5. So I want you guys to think back to your asthma management, and you know how it's a stepwise approach. And you start with your short acting, then you move to an inhaled corticosteroid, then you can either add in a long acting beta agonist or increase your inhaled corticosteroid. And then on your fourth step, you're going to do whatever you didn't do in step 3. And then step 5 is adding a whole bunch of stuff. But these 2016 guidelines started looking at adding tiotropium to that. And they did see some modest benefit, not anything that's going to knock it out the park, but enough to where you want to think about it in your difficult to control persistent asthma in patients in step 4 and step 5. It does not replace albuterol in any way, shape, or form. This is not going to replace your short or long acting beta agonists, but it is a good adjuvant therapy. Now, one of the downsides to it is the monthly cost is about $441 retail for a 1 month supply. So it may be cost prohibitive, but it may be a good adjuvant therapy in your difficult to control asthma patients.
That's good to know, Chris. It's always nice to think about your options, and especially you have to think about cost. So,
Absolutely.
Next, we have an article that's near and dear to my heart. It's a special article for the PA 50th anniversary entitled Female PAs, Where Are We Today? By the current AAPA president and chair of the board of directors, L. Gail Curtis, who's a PA, and Lauren Dobbs, also a PA, and Carol Hildebrandt, who's at Wake Forest University. So in summary for this article, female PAs have come a long way, but we have a long way to go on making pay equal and gaining leadership roles. So the authors of the article go through kind of the progress of PAs since the beginning of this growth of the PA profession. And even just since 2010, we've seen huge growth for a variety of different reasons. More women are working in general. More women are working in healthcare. More women are definitely working in the PA role. So just as an aside, though, a lot of what we know from information about the profession is from surveys. And most surveys usually ask respondents to self-identify as male or female. So I just want to take 1 second outside of the article to say that sex and gender are different things. Okay, so now back to the article. We learned from the article that in 1980, 38% of PAs were female, but now 68% of PAs are women. And also most PA programs now have a 3-to-1 ratio of women to men. So as we're progressing through time, we are gaining more leadership roles as women in the PA profession, but it's been slow. The article does highlight women in PA leadership roles since 1984. There's a really beautiful timeline, but it's still not balanced to how many men there are in leadership roles in the PA world, and that's a problem. Another huge problem on our hands in the PA world is that there's a really big pay gap between male and female healthcare workers and male and female PAs. It's not getting better, it's actually getting worse. Between 1987 and 1990, the gap for healthcare workers was 8%, but in 2010, it was 29%. And over a 40-year career, that's a difference of $1 million.
Wow.
For PA specifically, according to the 2016 AAPA salary report, women make a base salary that's generally $11,000 less than men. And according to a 2015 survey by a different group, eHealth Careers, male PAs made $13,000 more than female PAs. And it's not just salary, it's a total compensation package problem. And so a lot of people then say, well, there's a lot of different reasons for that, like time away from the office or hours per week or years of experience. But the discrepancy in pay exists when all variables are accounted for. So when you take away those variables and just compare male to female, that discrepancy still exists. Another explanation has been, well, maybe women are taking more roles in primary care. And we know that primary care just pays less than different specialties, but not so. Female PAs work in primary care 28% of the time compared to men at 25% of the time. So a little tiny difference, but not enough to account for the difference in pay. So just in summary, for all work in the United States, women are not paid equally for equal work in general or as PAs. And it's really an issue that we need to champion and we have to start talking about. The authors do a great job of highlighting the evolution of women through the PA profession and the evolution of that, and talk about some current and outdated concerns along with pay. They really balance out pros and cons of our progress. But my commentary on the article is this. When there are differences between how men and women are treated, with all else being equal, that's called sexism, and it just can't be tolerated.
I 100% agree. This is one of those things where, and I'm speaking to the male listeners at this point, but it's one of those things where we need to be champions just as much. When you see that there's something that's going on that you know is not right from a gender standpoint, or really from any standpoint where there's discrepancies and discrimination, you need to step up and you need to say something about it, because the standard that you let pass is the standard that you tolerate. And if it's not something that you would allow to happen, then you need to speak up and be able to do that. And I've definitely been in situations many a time in my clinical practice and in academic settings where, you know, you have to have those closed door meetings because of things that were said, and maybe they weren't meant that way. But it's definitely, you're right. As a society, we still have a long way to go, and certainly within our profession, we need to be champions on that.
Yeah, the first step is awareness. Maybe you didn't realize that. Like, you work with people all day long, you get treated equally, but did you know that your paychecks were so different? So first, to be aware, and we appreciate all the support we get, but to champion for yourself as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So the next article is an original research article entitled PAs in Primary Care, Current Status and Workforce Implications. And this is written by Betty Copeland, who's an associate clinical professor for the School of Healthcare Delivery at Arizona State University and part-time faculty member for the PA program at Northern Arizona University in Phoenix. Noel Smith, who's the Senior Director of PAs and Industry Research and Analysis for the AAPA, and Jim Cawley, who's a Professor of Prevention and Community Health and Professor of Physician Assistant Studies at GW University in Washington, D.C. So the numbers. Primary care visits account for over half of the 1 billion office visits in the United States each year, and the AAMC projected a deficit of up to 90,000 physicians, with a third of them being primary care physicians. Now, the trend that we've seen in primary care has been since the late 90s, we've saw a shift away from primary care for PAs to subspecialties. And there's a lot of commentary on that between the changes in the healthcare delivery models, subspecializations, obviously the pay is a big one. And although it is the second most common specialty for PAs, it represents only a quarter of clinically practicing PAs, which was a statistic that I thought was kind of staggering. On a side note, only 18% of jobs are listed as primary care. So it could be that they're just being added or advertised differently. Maybe it's an internal medicine job that does primary care. But still, only 20% of jobs are listed as primary care right now. So this was a survey analysis that they looked at the AAPA salary survey as well as the national AAPA survey. And what they found was that primary care PAs tend to be older and more experienced. Hispanics were much more common, and veterans were much more common. And this allowed some interesting analysis moving forward of what do we need to do in order to be able to strengthen our role as primary care providers within this healthcare system. So obviously salary is an issue. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So we need to be able to get our medical model back on track to where we're actually reimbursing and paying for prevention and primary care much more than we are the heart catheterization that happens after years of poorly controlled hypertension and hyperlipidemia. But that's a whole nother conversation. Marketing to PA programs for veterans can also be very, very beneficial. If we're finding out that more and more veterans are going into primary care, then PA programs need to step up to be able to help fill that void. And I know that there are several programs out there, and in fact, a lot of programs out there that market specifically to military veterans, because again, that's where the history of our profession lies, and they hold spots for them, or they have special consideration for them. And I think that's something that we can do on the academic side to be able to help with that. And then, of course, you know, the big elephant in the room is competitions with nurse practitioners and independent practice, and that's kind of where the OTP kind of came from. So if there's going to be this void in primary care and the nurse practitioners have independent practice, then it's going to be much easier for them to go out and get those jobs than it would be for a PA who is a dependent practitioner. And, you know, the politics that are going to go behind that, I think, over the coming years are going to be instrumental in terms of where we see our profession advance moving forward. So an interesting article that just looked at where our profession has come from and some of the data behind it and where we think we need to do to move forward to meet those needs.
Yeah. And when you look at the data, the strongest healthcare systems in the world all incentivize and focus on primary care and prevention. And that's where success comes from. I think it's obviously like something that we talk about as the bread and butter of PAs, but just anecdotally, I think a lot of us have seen grads want to go out and go into primary care, and sometimes the jobs just aren't there. So
right,
we can't really create the jobs for ourselves, and we have to, like you said, incentivize primary care. The pay has to be there, and the opportunities have to be there.
That's right.
So our final summary is a review article, The Effects of Obesity and Pulmonary Function in Children, by Courtney Durbin, Robin Egan, Kristen Gervaisi, Nicole Nadeau, Emily Neal, and Suzanne Reich, who are all PAs, and Tanya Gregory, PhD. So it's no surprise that obesity is rising in the United States and in kids. About 1 in 4 kids in the U.S. is obese. This article covers the effects of obesity on their respiratory system, exercise tolerance, and lung function. And so basically, obesity predisposes kids to asthma and obstructive sleep apnea. Kids are supposed to exercise for 60 minutes every single day, but that's hard for obese kids. They already have decreased lung volume and expiratory flow, and so it's not fun to exercise when you're overweight. And then that just compounds their asthma because they get short of breath, and then they need more steroids during asthma flares from being sedentary because of a pathophys process that diminishes reactive smooth muscle with sedentary lifestyle. OSA is the same type of cyclic kind of problem. It's increased in obese kids secondary to increased neck adipose tissue. But then when you have an obstructive sleep apnea, you're not sleeping as well. You have daytime somnolence, and that puts you at risk for a higher BMI, an earlier weight gain, and then just more sleep apnea, and then more daytime sleepiness and headaches and people don't want to exercise when they're sleepy or when they have headaches. So we have to think about asthma and OSA in our obese pediatric population, manage, educate, screen, and refer, promote healthy weight through healthy food choices and exercise, and manage both OSA and asthma complications. So just kind of highlighting those problems a little bit more, bringing them to your attention a little bit more. Credits. Sound and sound engineering is done by Chris Madej. If you haven't, subscribe to our feed on iTunes and give us a rating. Tweet at us too. Chris is at @PA_Madej, and I'm Adrian. I'm at The Art of EBM, all one word. Jaffa is at jaffa.com. And we want to say thanks to the support of Harrison Reed, the deputy editor of Jaffa. You can tweet at him at @HarrisonReedPA. So we hope to meet you back here next month.